With Commander Peter Birch Jones at his office in the Blanchard Building, November 23rd, 1983. All right, if we could begin without saying, I just ask you where you were born and when?
I was born in Esalen, Saskatchewan on December 10th, 1925, but I only lived there for 3 months. My parents returned to the West Coast to Vancouver and then Seattle and then eventually to Victoria in approximately 1929 or 1930. Where I've lived ever since, prior to joining the Navy, in any event.
Okay. So you joined the Navy, I believe you told me, in 1943?
Yes, by going to what was then called the Royal Canadian Naval College, HMCS Royal Roads at Hatley Park.
I see. Where did you go to school prior to this?
I went to St. Michael's Prep School in Victoria, and then a school called North Shore College in North Vancouver for 2 years, and then to Brentwood, and when I graduated from Brentwood, I joined the Navy and went to the Naval College.
Mm-hmm. What led you to your choice of the Navy?
I decided when I was at a very young age that I was going to join the Navy. I think it was the arrival of some Royal Navy ships in the 1930s, and the fact that my father knew some of the then pre-war Navy people like Commander Soulsby, and I was able to get in the dockyard when I was quite a young lad, and I think those kind of influences decided me. Had Royal Roads not started, I would have followed in the footsteps of a second cousin of mine by the name of Johnny Jones, who went over to the Royal Navy as a Frobisher cadet entry, and subsequently was a midshipman, unfortunately, in HMS Hood, and was blown up in that battle with the Bismarck.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any sort of family tradition of service? Were any of your other rest of your family?
No, not really. My father was a soldier in World War I, but that was the only connection. My great uncle arrived here in Victoria in the 1880s or 90s. As a surgeon lieutenant in a Royal Navy frigate, and subsequently left the Navy and became the first surgeon in Victoria. And his name is Dr. O.M. Jones, but he was the only naval influence that there was in my family.
So, okay, how long was your training program then at Royal Roads?
2 years. We graduated in 1945, in the summer, in July of 1945. And then I was appointed to join HMCS Ontario, and as such we joined a number 2 Canadian Army hospital ship called the Letitia in Halifax at the end of August, by which time the war of course was over. We sailed in the Letitia thinking we were going to the Pacific via Suez, and somewhat to our surprise we turned south and went down through the Panama Canal and out to Hawaii, where we then broke down for 3 weeks because of refrigeration problems with the Letitia. The Letitia had been sent out to pick up the Canadian prisoners of war from Hong Kong, and as such was a fully manned hospital ship because these prisoners of war were in pretty bad physical condition from their Hong Kong experience. Unfortunately, because of the length of time that we were broken down, the Americans had by this time picked up the Canadian ex-prisoners of war, and they arrived in Hawaii while we were still there waiting to go out. The 8 Canadian midshipmen who were on board had been destined to join HMCS Ontario, one of our cruisers, which was in the Pacific at that time, but she too was ordered home. And so we went on in the Letitia to the Philippines, not really knowing where we were going to end up. When we got to the Philippines, we were told that we were to join HMS Duke of York, which was the flagship of the British Pacific Fleet, and a KG-5 class battleship of approximately 40,000 tons.
Was this Commander Byron, or Admiral Byron in command at
this? No, Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser, as he was then, and then he became Admiral Lord Fraser. But Admiral Fraser was the Commander-in-Chief of the British Pacific Fleet, and his flagship was Duke York. We then flew from the Philippines, by this time as early late September. We flew to the from the Philippines to Hong Kong in an RNZAF Catalina, which is a two-engine flying boat, long-range patrol craft. And the eight midshipmen, with all their baggage and so on, managed to cram into this Catalina and fly on to Hong Kong, where we were then billeted in a accommodation ship, which had been a pre-war P&O liner, which was very, very comfortable and quite luxurious. This period lasted 3 or 4 weeks while the Duke of York was returning to Hong Kong, and we joined her in late November when she re-entered Hong Kong with Admiral Lord Fraser.
You were then based out of Hong Kong for some time?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We stayed in Hong Kong doing occupation duties with what was called Kennedy Force, which was a force of 600 to 800 Marines and sailors. While the Army gradually arrived, the 44th Royal Marine Commandos and the two companies of the Gloucester Regiment, as I remember it, gradually took over occupation duties from what was essentially a naval occupying force. The Japanese forces, of course, were used in a police capacity as well. And this period lasted until early on in the new year, when we sailed for Japan. We visited several areas in Japan, including both Nagasaki and Hiroshima, by which time this is approximately 5 months after the bombs had been dropped there. The experience with Nagasaki was quite interesting in that the ship, of course, was too large to get into the rather small horseshoe-shaped harbor, so we anchored outside, and the Americans came out in several landing craft to take our ship's company ashore to see Nagasaki in two lots, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. I can remember that as we came into the harbor at Nagasaki that there were a number of twisted and ruined Mitsubishi factory buildings around the edge of the harbor, but nothing to indicate the immensity and the enormity of a nuclear explosion. Rather more this kind of scene that you would see in a heavily bombed out port. There were a bunch of trucks waiting for us, however, and we got into these trucks and drove about 200 yards beyond these ruined, twisted buildings, and all of a sudden we came out on a vast plain with the odd gate or chimney still on it, but nothing else, and rubble the size of a man's fist stretching out before us, and this was what had been Nagasaki. It was then that we appreciated what kind of a bomb had been dropped there.
Was the entire ship's crew sent ashore to see this?
Yes, in two lots.
This was by orders, was it?
No, not necessarily by orders. I think an opportunity for us all to view something which was totally beyond our experience up to that time. Similarly, when we went to see Hiroshima, we then went on to Curie, which was by this time being established as the main Commonwealth base of the occupying forces in Japan. And Hiroshima was a town, a city, as I remember it, something like 30 miles away, further down the coast from Curie. And here, again, the same kind of vast devastation was witnessed, with the odd building gate or Shinto gate or chimney still standing. Interestingly enough, one of the few buildings that survived virtually intact, I remember, was a brewery, which stood all by itself in a vast sort of plain.
What did the rest of the crew seem to think of this? What was the sort of general reaction to witnessing this?
Well, it was somewhat, I think, similar to mine. First of all, the initial sight of the normal devastation made us think that this was not much different from normal, heavy, conventional bombing. And it wasn't until we got out on this vast plane and saw what had once been a city that we realized what had happened. And I think it was a very sobering experience for us all.
So there were Americans occupying the site at this time?
Yes.
Guarding the site?
Yes.
How did they look on this? Did you get a chance to...
By this time, they'd been there for at least a couple of months, and to them it had become a fairly accepted, commonplace thing for them. Of course, all the casualties had long since been evacuated and so on, so there were none to be seen. I gathered those who arrived initially right after the war saw many more scenes of far greater devastation and horror.
So then you were stationed in Curie from this point on, right?
No, we only stayed in Curie for about a month, if I remember it. And then we headed south to Sydney, Australia, where we went into dry dock for 6 weeks, having left the Admiral behind in Hong Kong at his house, which is called Admiralty House, which subsequently burnt down. Was destroyed in a rather spectacular fire. But we left the Admiral in Hong Kong and spent 2 months in Sydney, Australia, while the ship went into dry dock. And on leaving Australia, the Admiral flew down and joined us there, and we proceeded. By this time it was June, and we proceeded to wend our way in a rather leisurely fashion back to England, stopping at Singapore, where we didn't go ashore because of an epidemic of smallpox which was going on at the time. And then our next stop was at Trincomalee in Ceylon, where we spent several days there. And then our next stop was in Egypt, at Port Said, at one end of the canal. It was interesting, as we were going up the canal, a battleship draws so much water, i.e. about 35 feet, that it pushes a huge wall of water in front of it, and the pressures build up on either side of the canal, with the result that once a shear gets going and the pressures build up on one side, it bounces the hull off that side of the bank, and the shear gets worse and worse until the ship eventually runs aground. Bearing in mind that the bottom of the canal is only sand, this is not a serious thing, but the KG-5 class runs aground anywhere from a dozen to two dozen times when transiting that canal.
That must, in other words, it takes a lot longer than it would for a smaller, ordinary ship.
Yeah, right. A ship which is not drawing something like 35 feet ground.
In other words, it was just simply expected that you would run aground a certain amount of time.
And we did. I think the navigator was quite proud that we only ran aground, in our case, about six times, which is about half the normal rate. No damage was done to the ship, but there's a lot of thrashing around with the four screws to get ourselves pulled off.
Did you have to get pulled off at any point?
By tugs? I don't remember that happening. We then spent a week or so in Port Said, which was an experience. We had to be rather careful because the anti-British feeling against the British was building up fairly substantially then, and we were warned not to go ashore except in groups, and to stay in groups and so on. And there was no doubt that we did face a hostile environment there. Our next stop was at Malta, where we met up with a CNC med fleet. At that time was a gentleman by the name of Roderick McGregor. He was a very short, dapper little man, as I remember, who came on board to greet our admiral, who for some reason or other turned up in a normal white shirt and white shorts and white stockings and black shoes, which somewhat disconcerted Admiral McGregor, who was a very dapper man and a very stickler for dress and dress codes and so on. And I'm quite sure that Admiral Lord Fraser did this quite deliberately. Admiral Fraser, by this time, I should have mentioned, in January 1st, 1946, was made a baron and became Admiral Lord Fraser of North Cape, commemorating the sinking of the Scharnhorst, for which he had been responsible when he was the admiral of the CNC home fleet at the time. And the Scharnhorst was sunk by the Duke of York's guns, which is the last big battle between battleships, where one battleship was sunk entirely by gunfire. However, I after Malta, we stopped at Gibraltar. And my memory of that particular occasion was the enormous effort it took to warp the ship into the harbor at Gibraltar and past the narrow entrance of the breakwaters and getting it settled inside. And from Gibraltar, we made our way across the Bay of Biscay, where a very large and lengthy back to City Street party was thrown by the RNVRs, who were all leaving us on arrival back in the UK. And we arrived off Plymouth in early July, as I remember it, in the middle of a thick fog. And we had to anchor for a few hours before proceeding to a tumultuous welcome back to Plymouth, where there were about 200,000 people lining the cliffs and in the dockyard to welcome the Duke of York home. And it was my first experience of the UK, having gone to the Pacific via the other direction.
Was the Duke of York traveling in company at this time?
No, by this time she's traveling as a single ship. She didn't even have a destroyer escort with her. But of course, by this time it was peacetime and it was felt unnecessary.
Most of the Pacific fleet were still on station, were they? Or had they returned by this
time? No, the heavy units had all been returned. In the early months after the war, the British, I think, wished to make it clear that they were back with a vengeance. And I can remember at one time in Hong Kong Harbor in the late fall, or close to Christmas, we had three battleships, the Anson, the Howe, and the Duke of York. We had HMS Implacable, a fleet carrier. We had two light fleets, or three, Ocean Vengeance and Theseus. We had about four or five cruisers and a dozen destroyers, which comprised at that time the British Pacific Fleet. And they completely filled the harbor, needless to say. But after that period, the Far Eastern Station was quickly reduced to a much smaller force of a squadron of destroyers.
You might think this is a sort of curious question, but traveling home as you did via places such as Hong Kong and Singapore and Malta, where some of the most intense fighting of the war had gone on, were you regretful or relieved that you'd missed out on it?
Well, I think like most young men, I was very regretful that I'd missed out on the war and only saw its aftermath. I think that the rather intense training life that a midshipman goes through didn't really give you much time for that kind of reflection.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, about being a midshipman on a British battleship at this point.
Well, we found that as Canadians, we were first of all, the Admiral was particularly friendly to us young Canadians, and in fact made us feel very welcome and entertained us quite a lot when we were in the Hong Kong phase. And I subsequently kept up a correspondence with him until close to his death, and saw him again on many other occasions. The captain of the ship was an Angus Nicoll, who was a very cheerful, jovial man. And most of the senior officers, there was a huge staff on board, being the flagship. There was basically one full admiral, a Commodore First Class, who wears the rear admiral stripes, who was the chief of staff, called Evans Loam. And the captain was Angus Nicoll. There were about three other staff captains, staff captains, and about 17 commanders on board. There were also about 32 midshipmen down at the other end of the scale.
Was the Duke of York fitted out as a flagship?
Yes.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, very much so. And the majority of the senior officers were also very friendly to us. So our life as a midshipman on board, on the whole, was extremely pleasant. Marred at times by the actions of the commander, who was the only rather unpleasant gentleman that I encountered during my 10 months in the Duke of York as a midshipman. So all in all, it was a very pleasant experience. The training we got was quite extensive. Our time was spent in driving picket boats, 45-foot picket boats, when in harbor, in taking navigation lessons and theory of meteorology, and various other technical engineering subjects, as I remember, for which they had Royal Navy schoolmasters on board, schoolies. And half our time was spent in that kind of classroom experience, and the other half was spent out doing practical things like driving boats and being the commander's doggy and midshipman of the watch, etc., running the boat routines when at anchor, something you only really learn how to do if you serve in a big ship.
Would you yourself have served in a small ship, do you think, or did you appreciate...
Oh, it wasn't... I didn't get to small ships, of course, until later on, and then I spent more or less the rest of my service career in destroyers. So that I was always glad of having had the experience of serving in a battleship.
Okay. If we could jump ahead then to when you arrived back in England.
All right. Well, when we arrived back in England, we were then appointed a month. We were given some leave, and then we were appointed to a fleet carrier called HMS Implacable, which was up in Rosyth, anchored outside the Firth of Forth Bridge because she was too big to go under the bridge. And we spent the rest of our midshipman's big ship time up until January of 1947 in Implacable, in the home fleet, doing what were called clockwork mice. That is, we were the landing platform for people doing their carrier qualifications or requalifying, as the case may be. And at that time, we were flying, we were carrying what were called Sea Furies and Seafire 47s, which was the Marine version of the Spitfire. And we were also flying old ferry aircraft, which were torpedo bombers and very heavy and slow, as I remember them.
This would be the albacore or the swordfish?
No, not the swordfish. I think we also flew some Avengers as well. That period lasted, as I say, until early January. During that time, we did a cruise up the fjords to Bergen, where we had a marvelous 3 or 4 days with the Norwegians as a sort of post-war celebration, even though the war by this time was over a year. We were the first big ship to go in there since the end of the war. And I remember that is a very enjoyable period. We got back to Scotland and were then sent to destroyers in the home fleet. And I was sent to the Nor destroyer flotilla, HMS Cowdray, which is based at Sheerness. And we were supposed to do duty destroyer in Germany in a place called Cuxhaven. But in that very fierce winter of early 1947, all the German ports froze up, so there was no way we could get there. So unfortunately for us, our refit was advanced, and we were sent into dry dock in Chatham, where I then spent the coldest period of my entire service career as we froze in the grip of this fierce, fierce winter with no heat on board, and all the shore heads frozen, and one ancient bicycle with which we were allowed to ride up to the wardroom to use the heads whenever this was necessary. We had to rely on electric heat on board, and the British at that time, of course, were going through power cuts, particularly early in the morning. So we would sit looking at our tiny little electric grill in the wardroom, so-called heater, which would go from red to pale pink to black each morning, leaving us freezing on board. It must have been 10 degrees below zero. Absolutely the coldest time I've ever known. That period lasted for nearly 2 months before we were finally ordered to go and take our midshipman's, our lieutenant's qualifying exams at the end of our midshipman's time period, and mercifully went off to Dorset, to Weymouth, where we were to be examined on board HMS Nelson, was still in commission at the time, and anchored in Weymouth Harbor. We spent 2 days being examined, and all the Canadians were there, of course, by this time. And it was the first time we'd seen each other for at least a year and a half in many cases, having been scattered all over the British fleet in the various fleets of the Royal Navy, the home fleet, Mediterranean fleet, the Far Eastern fleet. And we joined up together there, went through the experience of our midshipman's exams with 2 days' worth, and then were flown back to Canada for our first leave after about 18 months.
Our midshipman's exams as horrifying as everyone?
They were very extensive, as I remember. There was a lot of seamanship involved. It was mostly a practical sort of thing. But the captain who examined us was a gentleman by the name of Hughes Hallett, who was sometimes called Hughes Hitler, who was a most unpleasant gentleman, as I remember. One of the few Royal Navy captains that I met who was distinctly unpleasant in his manner. And tried to sort of terrify us. Fortunately, the Canadians were a little more blasé and managed to weather this storm all right. He was also quite rude about the British Pacific Fleet, which we didn't appreciate too much, having served there with Admiral Fraser. After arriving home in Canada, we spent a few weeks in Canada and then back to the UK, where we went to the Royal Naval College, Greenwich, to commence our sub-lieutenant's courses.
Were the group of you still together at this point?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, all of us. By this time, we were a group of about 18, as I remember it.
Okay, so how long did the sub-lieutenant's course last?
Okay, the sub-lieutenant's courses lasted 10 months at Greenwich, which is sort of general education and war course, where we took naval history, applied mechanics, some mathematics, some chemistry, a little bit of basic metallurgy, basically and some physics. I can remember our physics instructor being a gentleman of some considerable interest, whose chief claim to fame was that he was Margaret Rutherford's brother. He had some of the wit for which that lady was extremely famous. And after 10 months at Greenwich, we proceeded down to Portsmouth, where we did our sub-lieutenant's practical courses in gunnery, navigation, communications, damage control, and including a basic flying course at Gosport, Royal Naval Air Station Gosport, where we learned to fly in open cockpit Tiger Moths in the middle of the English winter, which is still a formidable winter, I might add. And my most vivid memory of that experience is how cold we were flying around in these World War I type Snoopy cockpits.
There were no more modern aircraft available to train
on? No, this was just the basic training vehicle. Tiger Moth is a great aircraft to learn to fly in because it's practically impossible to crash it.
All right, and upon completion of your courses, then you were...
We were then sent back to Canada, where we were appointed to various Canadian ships. And being a West Coaster, I was very pleased to be appointed to HMCS Crescent, which was an Esquimalt-based destroyer at the time. There being three destroyers and two frigates, which were commissioned only in the summer months, operational on the West Coast at the time, three destroyers being Cayuga, Athabasca, and Crescent.
Crescent was... What type of ship?
CR class, British CR class.
Was there no facilities in Canada at this point for the sub-lieutenant's training, the type that you took at Greenwich and Portsmouth?
Nothing like the fleet school facilities that we subsequently developed. We did, after the Korean War started, begin to develop facilities which resulted in severing our training ties with the Royal Navy, but this wasn't until the Korean period began.
So at this point it was common practice then for training officers to go to England?
Yes.
Yeah.
By this time the RCN had diminished from its post-war high, including reserves of 100,000, and we were back in 1948 when we got back to the Royal Navy, down to 7,600 officers and men in total. So a dramatic drop in a 3-year period.
Okay. So the Crescent then was, as you say, summer commission only. So
no, the Crescent Cayuga and Athabasca were in full commission. The Anakinish and Beacon Hill were the two frigates, and they were, if my memory serves me correctly, were in commission only in the summer months to do reserve and cadet training for the UNTDs, which by this time was beginning to get underway, University Naval Training Division program. In Crescent, in January, we were given orders to, they were top secret orders as I remember it, to prepare to proceed to China with all dispatch, and there to place ourselves under the orders of the Canadian ambassador in Nanking, the Honorable T.C. Davis, and to look after the interests of Canadians in the Nanking area.
I'm sorry, your position on Crescent at this point? You're
at that time, I was then the gunnery officer and the navigator as well. My confrere, the other sub-lieutenant, was the communications antennas officer. The captain, who was David Groose, believed in loading up his sub-lieutenants with quite considerable responsibility and then booting our tails around the ship to make sure that we accomplished what he thought was necessary. He's a very experienced captain, and a pretty hard man to please at times. Fortunately for the ship, it was decided to send an ND Dagger with us on that particular trip as a special navigator, and a gentleman by the name of Kai Bogle joined us. So I, somewhat to my relief, became the assistant navigator, but I retained my responsibilities as the ship's gunnery officer. We set sail for China and proceeded to Hawaii, and then ocean hopping across the American islands like Midway and Guam and so on, until we got to Shanghai, taking about, as I remember it, three weeks to get there, which is about as fast as we could go, and still have enough fuel to make the hops across the Pacific. Just before we got to Shanghai, our orders were changed, and we were placed under the orders of the flag officer, second in command, Far Eastern Station, based in Shanghai, on board a British cruiser called HMS London, and became part of the 8th Destroyer Flotilla. And Captain D8, based in flying his pennant in HMS Cossack, which is a British CO type destroyer. Not too dissimilar from Crescent, but of a later vintage.
Were you aware at this time of what the situation was in China? How bad it was?
Yes, we were aware of the fact that the communists were clearly winning the war. It was a question of when and how quickly and by what means. When we arrived in Shanghai, we began to face some of the problems that subsequently led up to being one of the contributing factors to our mutiny in Nanking, which occurred some weeks later. Shanghai by this time was under martial law, and under the mayor of Shanghai was Chiang Kai-shek's brother-in-law, as I remember. And there was a curfew, and unless you had a diplomatic pass, you could not proceed ashore at night. The result is that our men, although the invitations were issued to them in groups of 30 and 40 per day, had little opportunity to get ashore except during daylight hours, and were not able to stay ashore in the evening. On the other hand, the officers were besieged by invitations from the British and Canadian communities there, who in true Far Eastern fashion will have cocktail parties and parties while the very walls are crashing down around their ears. And so the captain decided that we would attend all of these functions as being part of our sort of showing the flag and diplomatic responsibilities. The result is that the officers would just about run off their feet, while very little proportionately was available for the men. This was no one's particular fault, it's just the way life was and what it was like out there. Certainly we had far more invitations than we could possibly cope with, being a fairly small ward of only about 12 officers. Subsequently, we were also, as part of the 8th Destroyer Flotilla, we came more and more under the scrutiny of the flagship, and were made to follow various British routines, which added to some of the difficulties and irritations that our men were already experiencing.
What sort of routines would those be?
Well, the changes to the times of doing certain things. From our normal Canadian Esquimalt-based routine times for harbor routines and so on, to the routines that the British followed in Shanghai. It just involves some basic changes in time and so on. But all of these things are sometimes quite an irritant to sailors who get used to a particular routine and don't like changing it. And the fact that we were flying the White Ensign, of course, still in those days, the British, whenever they see another White Ensign ship and they're senior to it, reckon that they can tell it what to do, regardless. We sailed from Shanghai after a fairly lengthy stay there of about 3 weeks, anchored out in the off the Bund, the international settlement there, in what's called the Wangpu River. We sailed down the Wangpu and then went up the Yangtze. The trip up the Yangtze takes 2 days. We had Chinese pilots with us at the time because you had to anchor at night in a particular place where you had to black out and wait until the next morning, because if you tried to go up at night, it was a navigational hazard to start with, and the pilots wouldn't do it. But if you anything seen moving at night on the river was shot at. So that quite clearly we had to not only anchor, but we had to douse all our lights and so on.
This would be shot at by nationalists or by the communists?
Anybody.
Anybody.
We were closer to the south bank, which was occupied by the nationalists, but by this time the communists were occupying the north bank. We proceeded up the next day to Nanking and came alongside what was called a Hoji Godown, which was a big shed-like area with metal pontoons along the edge of the riverbank, which was secured to the riverbank floating, and we secured these metal pontoons.
How many ships were there in the flotilla?
Just one.
Just yourself?
We went up and relieved HMS Cossack, who went down, Captain D.H. ship, went down to Hong Kong to wait their next turn as duty destroyer up in the area. And you stayed there, as I remember, for about 2 weeks. The idea being that if we had to evacuate the 26 Western embassies that were up there, we would lay down a barrage at the far side of the city, which would creep back towards the jetty, which would keep everybody back until we got all these people evacuated through the town. The concern was not what would happen when the communist troops arrived, but what would happen with the nationalist troops during the interval before they arrived, because by this time the nationalist troops were not being paid, were hardly being fed, but were still heavily armed, and were clearly deteriorating quite rapidly. And the concern was not what the 250,000 communist troops would do when they took over the Nanking area, but what the nationalists would do before that event, and there were about 150,000 of them, pretty heavily armed. Again, the same sort of thing happened up in Nanking, where the officers with the 26 Western embassies were again run off their feet because we were new faces. And the Commonwealth and the Canadian and American embassies in particular had a lot of evening receptions for us. There was a rather miserable shed on the edge of the riverbank, which had been used as a sort of canteen area by the Royal Navy, in which we provided beer and so on, British beer by this time, for the troops, but it was pretty sparse and Spartan experience for them. One particular night when I was officer of the day, we had arrived with a whole lot of British beer for the British Embassy piled on our deck, and it had been moved ashore that day for a British Embassy truck to come down and pick it up. And of course this involved taking it across the steel pontoons up a small brow up onto the stone side of the riverbank. And these, I would guess, 100 cases of wooden cases of beer in large British beer bottles were all stacked up on the edge of the riverbank. The officers were due to go ashore for another evening at some embassy, and I can remember as being the only officer left on board. We had armed guards at the stern, armed guards at the bow, and an armed sentry at the brow by the... This meant, of course, that the duty watch was up a great deal more throughout the night to man all these additional positions that we normally didn't have. It was also pelting with rain that night, and its tidal all the way up to Nanking. The captain decided that it would be most unwise to leave this beer unguarded out on the jetty, so he told us to put an additional sentry on it. Now that meant 3-4 hour watches throughout the night. That meant 3 additional men. So I sent for the coxswain and advised him that the captain wanted the sentry out there on the jetty, on the riverbank as well, an armed sentry to guard this beer. And I can remember the coxswain pointing out to me that the duty watch wouldn't be very happy with that. And so I said, all right, we've got an alternative. If the duty watch wants to turn up now, we'll lug all that stuff back on board, and then we don't have to guard it during the night. So put it to them, which they prefer to do, mount a guard all night, or alternatively lug it back on board. And the coxswain said they want to lug it back on board, so I said, all right, let's go to it. And it was pouring with rain, I can really remember this. So we lugged all these 100 cases of beer back on board. And by this time, the river had risen quite appreciably, and just as we got the last of the beer on board, the brow became too short because of the rising tide and fell in the water, so that although we were still securely alongside the pontoons, the metal pontoons, we no longer had any link with the shore. Fortunately, we rescued the brow from being swept away, and by this time quite swiftly moving river, and we're in the process of nailing some additional planks onto the bottom to make it longer so that we could reach it back, and we're just wondering how we were going to get somebody up the riverbank and on the shore side to haul it back up there when the officers arrived back from their reception at about 23:30 or close to midnight, so that they were able to drag the brow back up to the riverbank and restore our connection with the shore.
None too pleased that they're not doing it, isn't right?
Anyway, they came on board, and I was told to get the duty watch turned in, and you know, and I can remember going down into the mess decks and noticing that it was very quiet down there. The men were still sort of sitting around and talking, but very quietly, and the whole ship was very quiet, unusually quiet. So I told them to turn in. We'd had a long, hard day and a long, hard night, and we'd be up early in the morning, so they'd get turned in, which they did. The next morning when I was on deck at 6:30, I noticed that there was a rather unusual number of chiefs and POs on the upper deck. And by the time we had hands fall in at 7:50, we had virtually every chief and petty officer in the ship was on the upper deck, and virtually none of the men. The coxswain sent for his leading seaman and said, go up forward. No, he said, on second thought, I'll go. And he went up forward, and he came back and reported to me that a number of the men were in the forward upper mess deck, having locked themselves in there by securing the watertight clips and lashing them on the inside. With the result, there's no way except by burning a hole through that watertight bulkhead could we ever get in there or get at them, make contact. So I went and reported to the first lieutenant, and the first lieutenant went and reported to the captain that we appeared to have what would be in modern day terms called a sit-down strike, but in those days was still called a mutiny. The captain made an address on the broadcast system saying that he would pipe the hands to fall in 15 minutes' time, and they were to come out at that time. A message came out that a leading seaman, Rudolph, was coming out as an emissary with a list of demands. Rudolph being a large, jovial, rotund man, well-liked by both the officers and men, and reputing to be married to Admiral Menge's, then Captain Menge's niece, a claim which was never verified one way or the other. Anyway, Leni Seaman Rudolph appeared with this list of demands, the first of which was to fire the first lieutenant, and a subsequent number of other demands being made. The captain said he would see individuals as requestmen, anybody who wished to state a grievance as an individual, but he would not speak to the group as a whole, now or at any other time. And once more, he would pipe hands fall in, at which time he expected them to come out and fall in. He would then order captains for requestmen to be held so that they could, if they wished to, individually, one by one, state a grievance. The pipe was made and out they came. So the duration of the mutiny, I would say, in terms of its actual the men refusing to come out was somewhat less than 1 hour.
How many of them were there?
86, as I remember. Close to 90. Most of our seamen and all of our stokers. The captain then ordered requestmen to be piped, and virtually all of these people lined up around the forecastle, right around the forecastle from one side to the other, then into the forward house where the captain's cabin was located, the forward superstructure. By about 11:30, the line had only moved forward by about 15 people or so, and the rest, when the rum ration and the lunch was getting ready, grew either discouraged or disinterested, and gradually drifted off. And the business of people requesting the state grievance was over by noontime. I can remember the captain sending for all the officers and say, can any of you put any light, shed any light on this and what has happened? And at the time, we honestly couldn't. We knew that the men were somewhat disgruntled, but there was no real indication that it was anything like as bad as this action would appear to justify. A day later, we got the electrifying news that two other destroyers at almost the same time, not exactly the same time, but almost the same time, had also mutinied down in Manzanilla Bay in Mexico.
Two other Canadian?
Yeah, two other Canadian destroyers. And so for a long time, there was some suspicion that this was a very, very skillfully coordinated and planned mutiny attempt. And the subsequent investigation, which was known as the Menge Report, was never able to prove this in any way. To the best of our knowledge, we were not in any communication links with the other two ships at any time. We were the whole Pacific Ocean apart.
What were the men requesting when they went to the captain's request?
They were stating a grievance of certain conditions of service, which of course KR and AI, as it was then, King's Regulations and Admiralty Instructions for the RCN, you were entitled to do as